Did you ask?
Yes, my mother, was Annie Lawrence Worthington, later Reed. My father was Charles H. Reed. My mother was the daughter of the originator of the Eastus newspaper and brother of John D. Worthington, later editor of the newspaper. My father started out as a bank runner when he was about 14 years old because he had to help support his very poor mother and large family who were living in Darlington, I believe, in his early youth. Grandfather Reed ran a grocery store, as I learned only recently by receiving a picture from Elva Hall, wife of Ned Hall, who one day brought me a picture of my grandfather's grocery store in the middle of Darlington. The reason I knew so little about him was that his children talked incessantly of their mother but said nothing about their father. That takes no further comment for me because I'm not capable of further comment. We lived, according to my first recollections, at the corner Broadway and Hickory Avenue. 219 Broadway was the number. That is now the State Farm Mutual Insurance Office. My father was great on the most modern inventions and gadgets. He had a very early Ford car, which I drove by sitting on his lap on frequent occasions. He had a very early model of an oil-burning furnace with full electrical controls. Other things like that seemed interesting very much. Very early radio, and I can remember several radios that contained numerous dials, and the listeners always felt lucky if they could get the station in any audible manner. I remember listening to the Berlenbach and Paulino prize fight over the radio, and if I remember correctly, there were several Broadway friends listening to the radio at the same time. The loudspeakers were extremely poor, so everyone thought to use earphones, but at the most two people could use the earphones, so we frequently had to use the wretched loudspeakers. At that period of my life, there was nothing but an open field in what became East Broadway, or Broadway Extended, as it was known. That stretched its open territory, except for one or two old houses, Hill Road. Sometime during my fairly early childhood, Mr. John Kunkel built the house which Dr. Philip Heumann now owns, and Dale Cole built a house next to it. Robbie Wallace's father built a house across the street, and other houses followed in turn until Webster's Addition was fairly well occupied. My companions were really very interesting people. Next door to me was the Brummel family, the grandparents of Tommy Brummel, the present town commissioner. The Deans were across Broadway, the Carvers next, Maccabees next, and so on up the street. I do remember that my dear friend Lucille Robinson was not far up the street, where she was reared by her grandfather, Mr. Thomas H. Robinson, probably then Attorney General of Maryland, and his wife, who was most solicitous of her granddaughter's welfare and very kind and affectionate toward her. Lucille Robinson is the present wife of Judge Albert Close. Other very interesting people were the members of the Higginbotham family, who lived in a place where there's now a dentist office. That was John and Edward, now Judge Edward Higginbotham. Across the street from him lived the Kehoe family, most prominent member now being Jimmy Kehoe, the head of athletics at the University of Maryland for a long time, and still connected with athletics at the University of Maryland. Now, there was another University of Maryland luminary, two doors away from him, at Thomas W. Hall. I don't know what Roman numeral follows Thomas W. Hall's name, because I know his ancestry goes back to the owner of Constant Friendship, which borders the Kennedy Highway now. Mm-hmm. A little farther down Broadway toward the west, with the Yellett family, the family of the rector of Emmanuel Episcopal Church, which my father attended devotedly. In that family, among the younger children, was Elaine Yellett, my contemporary, and an older member of the family, the senior Yellett child, was Dr. I. John Yellett, who is truly renowned in the field of steam physics. The minister of the First Presbyterian Church, which my mother attended, and in which she later became the first female elder, had as its pastor the Reverend George W. Mead, who was perhaps as great a preacher from what I remember and can understand from others' accounts, one of the greatest ministers that Harford County ever had. He lived with my great uncle, J. Lawrence McCormick, at the old stone house, which is now occupied by my very great, great friend, Mr. Orley G. Reedy. Are there other things that you think you would be interested in that my recollection?
Well, what was it like growing up in Bel Air? Was it a very large town?
Oh no, Bel Air was very small. My recollection part of statistics is poor, so far as that growing up era is concerned. But I'm sure there were not more than 1,000 people within the town limits at that time. I recall early police duties being performed by a man named Lingen, who died as a result of taking a torpedo firecracker away from some boy and putting it in his pocket and having the boy smash the torpedo within his pocket and cause him fatal blood poisoning. Main Street was a delight. It was lined with trees. People would come from far and wide to comment on the beauty of Bel Air, where the trees met in over the middle of the street, and everyone would vie for places to tie a horse to avoid the heavy summer sun. The horse trough, of course, was in full use, and the iron fence was around the courthouse building. One of the sad events of my recollection was the destruction of the old jailhouse, truly a landmark. It's my belief that it was of log construction. I recall the iron fence around that area, the sheriff's house and the jail, which was always, and the yard was always beautifully tended by the trustees. The county, I remember, about at the time of my college days containing approximately 40,000 people. I remember that because I read an account of a Russian fiefdom where serfs were owned, and the whole area contained about the same number of people, and I related that to my home county at the time. It was pleasant growing up in Bel Air, to say the least, because everyone knew everyone else, except for the influx of people from the country on Saturday night. That was truly a busy time. And people would be there whom the residents would see on no other occasion. They were easily distinguished by their dress and their withdrawn manner. Of course, there were some pretty tough young fellows around the town, too, who would make life miserable for girls and women passing by. The favorite occupation on Halloween was to get an enormous roller that stood on the school grounds and drag it to some inaccessible place by means of 50 boys pulling and hauling. The Harford County Fair was a marvelous annual event. I suppose even more exciting to me, however, was what was called Field Day, held at the fairground early in May of each year under the auspices of the Playground Athletic League, where high school and grammar school students would compete in volleyball teams, softball teams, and also trying to earn their bronze, silver, gold badges under the, given out by the Playground Athletic League to all who would qualify. I remember being in a competition myself at a fairly early age, which was called the baseball throw for accuracy. Early in the day, somebody painted about a 20-foot circle, and I clearly remember found a cow skull and put it in the center for the bullseye. Well, that is pretty close to being a bullseye. It was a cow's eye socket, anyway. And the winner on the baseball throw for accuracy that day was Johnny Clark, the attorney. And I came in third, a very happy third, I must say. I remember being at the fairground on the day and at the time when it was announced that Lindbergh had landed in Paris. And Jimmy Kehoe, whom I've mentioned previously, had a brother born on that day, so of course his name is Lindbergh, Lindy Kehoe. I remember, too, the people on Franklin Street, colored families, as we called them then. And by the way, the family that owned the property next door to our own house on Hickory Avenue was colored, and their names were Otis Hall and Molly Hall, and we lived in beautiful harmony with them until Mrs. Hall died at a very advanced age. He was a waiter at the Kenmore Inn, located where the Safeway now stands at the intersection of Main and Baltimore Pike. That was a great place for people from Baltimore to visit on Sunday because they served the most marvelous Sunday dinners there, and it was known far and wide. I was talking of the families on Franklin Street. The Clark family was a wonderful group of people who lived opposite Miss Blanche Cox's present house. There is at least one member of that family that I know is still living, and probably a number of others. In addition to them, there was Miss Blanche Cox herself, whom I did not know, but I certainly knew her brother well, because he was about 5 years my senior, and consequently I looked to him for protection and guidance, comfort and friendship. Across the street, and I think possibly in the double house occupied by the Clark, was a man whom I knew when I was perhaps 10 or 11. He was in college, whose name was John Ruff, a most marvelous athlete. He was very powerfully built, but he was a fast runner, and his athletic specialty was the broad jump. I remember one day that he was practicing his specialty in a pit where one of the spectators stands now sits, when one of Dr. Bird Hopkins' little children ran right into the pit while he was in midair. And it was the most fantastic maneuver I've ever seen, the way he avoided putting his spikes into that child. He spread his legs and tumbled at the same time, and the child wasn't touched. He would also throw footballs to us younger boys
and could easily throw 50 yards with the fat football that we had at that time. Speaking of the little Hopkins boy, makes me think of their father. Now that is the father of James Hopkins, who teaches at Harford Community College, or who used to teach drama. Dr. Hopkins, one of the most generous men ever seen in these parts. He never sent a bill for his medical services. At the time of his death, I believe, without knowing the details, that his former patient sent in thousands of dollars to clean up his estate and help his widow. His contribution to young people growing up here was beyond anything anyone knows now. Without pay, he coached track events, and it was he who brought Jimmy Kehoe from being a skinny, frail, and rather undernourished boy delivering newspapers to being a world-class mile runner. At the same time, he was working with Charlie Irwin, Bobby Archer, Jack Archer, Million Daniker, Herbert Joynes, Tommy Brooks, anybody else who was interested in him or in the sport that he was so fond of. There was total integration between his family and the Brooks family that lived one block east from his home. And I have often seen his children and the Brooks children trading licks on a single ice cream cone. One of the funniest phenomena I recall was the store of Pat Bodie, which was right next door to the Hopkins house toward the west. He sold candy to the school children. The large candies were a penny a piece. The smaller ones, several for a penny. He was not above selling samples to the children too, as I remember, as soon as I learned to read, buying something that said free sample not to be sold, but that didn't stop Pat Bodie. It also didn't stop the children from stealing from him. He kept his money in a cigar box somewhere inside the counter, and there was always a larum-larum fella and a little fella who would team up the small one to divert Pat's attention, and the tall one to reach a few coins out of his cigar box. Anything else you think I have to answer?
What was your school life like?
The first grade teacher, whom I never had because my mother taught me at home, Freeman, right, was Miss Alice Coburn, universally known as Duckfoot, because of her walk. No one knew how old she was. I'm not sure that she did, but she certainly took care of the first graders for many years. Second grade was a lovely lady, Miss Nellie Ruth Bagley, later not anybody. And in third grade was Miss Bessie Kelly, older sister of Mrs. Frances Goldenberger. In fourth grade was Miss Hattie Bagley, sister to Nellie Ruth, and one of the great sources of wild tales in the neighborhood while she was in her 40-some years of teaching practice. The school bell was in her room. So she had to signal the opening and closing of schools in the early days. She also kept the clock, which never had a glass space within the recollection of living persons. Consequently, the hands were easily within the day. Someone would always arrange to walk past the clock and drag it 5 to 10 to 15 minutes ahead so school would let out early. While I was still in the grammar school, the so-called new high school was built. Well, I was, I think, in high school, yes, in high school, the addition was built at the southern end of that brick building. We had what was called manual training in a wooden building still serving duty at the southerly end of the school lot before you get to the playing field. I remember that there were some people, boys who came up from North Carolina who were men by the time they reached here, but they hadn't gotten past the 8th or 9th grade, so they were serving time in school. During a manual training class one day, I taunted the older one by asking him how the still on the family farm was working. I never did that again because the ball peen hammer went over my head with such force it would have crushed my skull if it had hit it smart. Ben Miller was the principal I first remember, and his vice principal was Earl T. Hawkins, later president of Hazen College. John Bond was a music teacher, also teacher of physics and chemistry. Mariana Powell was the excellent teacher of history, U.S. history. Mrs. Frances Long, née Carroll, was the English teacher, and a fine one she was. And Henrietta Rose was the French teacher. No one should miss the knowing about Mr. Webster and his harem of unmarried teachers who lived at Circle Inn at the intersection of Gordon Street and Main Street, just opposite the Flatiron Corner. He was a ready escort for any of the teachers who wanted to go to the movies or to move around the town at night, as ladies did not then do alone. And since he was then in his 80s, he could be trusted to be courteous, considerate, and friendly at all times. That boarding house was run by Miss Forward, who is Mrs. Forward, or Miss Forward, I suppose, who is the aunt of Virginia Forward, Tate, what's her name now?
Wetter,
sure. Ed Wetter's wife, yes. Behind the room where we're sitting now was the Motor Sales Company, which was the Chevrolet agency run by Mr. Howard S. O'Neill and Herbert Hanna. It moved across the street later, and Mr. O'Neill went out of the automobile business. Anything else you think of?
How did you choose to become an attorney? When did you decide that was going to be your profession?
Very late. I had thought I would be a school teacher when I was in college, but my father, who had an insurance business, was taken seriously ill, and I entered that business with the late Florence R. Harris, my cousin. I was not a good insurance man and was not well adapted at that time to any business endeavor, since I had been only in academic circumstances for 6 years and was really out of touch to a large degree with my own community. So, in the process of trying to help Lawrence Harris run my father's insurance business, I took a year, half a year, at the University of Maryland Knight School of Law because my father strongly recommended it. I found it so terribly boring that I stayed out of school and tried for a year to determine what I really did want to do with my life. To my utter surprise, nothing seemed to be so suitable to my inclinations as being a lawyer. So a year later, I went back to law school, only to be called to military service in January of 1942. Indeed, I received my notice to report to the Naval Reserve the day after Pearl Harbor. After spending 4 years in the Navy, I walked right back into the law school with as much certainty as if I had never left it, was never bothered by the interlude, if you can call a war an interlude, in any way, and with the help of the dean of the law school, Dean Howell, I obtained a job as Judge Morris A. Soper's messenger and chauffeur, one of the finest experiences anybody could possibly have. He was a U.S. Circuit Court judge and the highest legal officer in the state of Maryland at that time.
And so then, how did you come back to Bel Air to set up your practice? How did that happen?
Well, after talking to the dean, he said that if I wanted to participate in the life of the community, I should come back to Harford County and get involved in its politics and the pulse of its life and set out my shingles here rather than trying to establish some sort of practice in a large city office. And that is exactly what I did. It was in the early summer of 1947 that Albert T. Close and I, now Judge Close, came to Bel Air and set up an office in the same building, and I have been here ever since. While Judge Close, Judge Stanley Blair, and most recently Judge Broadnax Cameron have moved to the courthouses.
Have you enjoyed being a lawyer so much that you don't, you have not been interested in becoming a judge, or do you?
No, that is not what has occurred at all. That was the time when I would have liked very much to be a judge. But my makeup was not considered by my peers to be suitable for that job. I have always been a strong participant in fights for things that I believed in deeply, such as the struggle for world peace through world government, the fight for the integration of the school, and things of that sort, which have brought a certain amount of obloquy upon me from time to time. It is a dreadful thing to be called a communist when you have four small children that you're trying to support and need the confidence of the public to make a living. It's a terrible thing, too, to hear your friends berate you because you believe in social justice. But when I attended my very first meeting as a member of the Board of Education at Harford County, I said, let's start planning now for the integration of the school. It was interesting to me because Judge Sofler had told me that someday the Supreme Court was going to decide the question of integrating the public schools. So when I came back to start practice, I thought I would be able to influence opinion toward a voluntary integration of the public schools. Little did I know how obdurate the conservative element of this community and other communities could be, and how vicious at the time I got on the Board of Education, there was a case filed in federal court that was being revived because Harford County's slow-paced integration plan had changed from voluntary transfers by application to the integration of certain classes. And the infuriating thing to the black community, and to me too, was that simultaneously with the required integration of certain classes, the voluntary or applied for transfer to integrated schools was abolished by a majority vote of the board members. And that question litigated under the old pending case in the U.S. District Court in Baltimore City. That was a better time for me because, or trying time, not better, trying, because I was writing to testify against my co-passengers in the same vehicle as we traveled towards the courthouse. I might mention, too, that one other thing that happened to me was helping to form the first Human Relations Commission, an entirely voluntary group of blacks and whites that later formed the basis for the governmental group that the charter presently requires. All those things that I've tried to do have made enemies or have led people paste the radical label on me, and that's not conducive to the judicial appointment. Also, they might not think that, might not have thought I had the other qualities. The reasons that may be obscured to me, and I'm sure they are in part.
Now, how did you get involved with the World Federalists?
Oh, when I saw the dreadful significance of war firsthand, I resolved that whatever could be done to prevent another war, I would do, no matter what the cost. And that's what I've done ever since then. Through thick and thin, when the idea was popular and when it wasn't popular. And still, today, I'm fighting against the provincialism of the an administration that has torpedoed or has put an end to progress. The Law of the Sea Convention and trying to work for an international agreement, whether it be SALT II, SALT III, or whatever it might be. Because it is terribly apparent to me that the collection of arms, to the extent of being able, of either side being able to obliterate the other side many times over, does not bring security to either side. And I feel that it is simply folly to pile up more and more armaments, which only increase the danger that either by mistake or by design or in desperation, somebody will use the weapons that are available. Agree with Pogo's pronouncement. We I have met the enemy, and they is us.
Now, what also about your involvement with the Unitarian Fellowship? Could you talk a little bit about that group and your involvement with them?
Yes. And that is a very difficult thing, because it's a painful thing for me. And it was perhaps the most painful thing in my mother's life, being the ardent Presbyterian that she was. That I would leave the Presbyterian Church in which I had grown up and in which I had participated ever since I was old enough to be carried there. For whatever reason, I came to a position where I could not subscribe to the credos of any of the traditional churches. And so I joined a church that has no credo of that sort, except a belief that religion is tremendously important and that everyone should make a search for truth as he or she observes it, learns about it, studies about it, and that in the meantime, and also that socially, we should work for the benefit of our fellow humans, wherever they may be, regardless of whether it is in China, in Africa, South America, Russia, England, or any other country anyone wishes to name. I believe that all men and all women are created equal. They have a great deal of inequality thrust upon them, but as creatures, they have an equality and an equal worth. So, I joined the First Unitarian Church of Baltimore and commuted there for on Sundays. Commuted to wrong word. Traveled there on Sunday with my wife Lois and our four children. But it was a tiring trip for the children. It was really 4 hours on the road in the church and back on the road again. So, the Woodward and the Reed and one other person made up the required number for establishing what is called a fellowship under the then Unitarian, American Unitarian Association. It's now acquired an even more difficult name, Unitarian Universalist Association, because the Universalists and the Unitarians joined forces about 15 years ago.
So now with your involvement between the work with integration and with the Federalists and the Unitarians, how have you seen the community change, you know, over the, say, the 50s and the 60s and 70s? What are some of the occurrences, you know, things that you remember?
Well, the schools are at last integrated. That's one thing. One of our leading members on the county council is a black man. Black people have friends in the white community, and white people have friends in the black community in a sense that they never have before, certainly not when I was growing up. My mother subscribed to that same principle out of Christian conviction, and it was no tiny thing for her to sit for the first time in her life at a table with a person with a brown skin. That's been a tremendous amount of progress that's occurred. I had a secretary here for 5 years who was black. She's now serving in a public office. I've seen a very little progress toward an understanding of what is needed to make a peaceful world. I think it has been blocked to a great extent by the Christian belief that the world has to be Christianized before it can be peaceful. It will cease to exist if we have to wait that long, because the majority of the world's people are not Christian, however much that might be desired or however much it might be desired by the ruler of the universe. But at any rate, I think our leaders have failed to perceive the futility of constantly increasing armaments. If we could use the funds that we now devote to military measures and change them in alleviation of poverty and ignorance and disease, certainly be a vastly improved world. What was the other thing? The wonderful thing about my life here has been that no matter how or thought my ideas form of madness, I've always been tolerated, always been treated well, tormented a little bit, but tolerated and been permitted to express my views. And that's a glorious thing. The practice of law has been afforded me a wonderful life. The community has offered me everything that I ever really hoped for. And My age has increased. I've become appreciative of people who disagree with me. I've not only come to expect it, but to really like the fact that others may disagree with me, and we will still keep talking and even enjoying each other's company. I remember Judge Higginbotham telling me about his experience when he was a soldier in Europe. He was invited to a Catholic family's house, who suggested that he bring some of these friends. He said, well, I've got two friends, but they're both Protestants. How can they be your friends, said the host, if they're both Protestants? Now, that's the sort of thing we find hard to believe here, because we have grown so accustomed to tolerance for other people's point of view. And those of us who had opportunity to travel to strange lands know what a marvelous privilege it is to be in a place where you never have to fear expressing your own ideas.
Have the politics of the county changed a lot since you first began practicing?
Yes, I think so. Strangely enough, I have always been an advocate of a stronger Republican Party. One of my reasons for that has been that I felt it virtually impossible to improve the character of the Democratic Party unless the Republican Party was actively, vociferously criticizing the Democrats. The Republicans were in such a minority that it was hard to hear their voices or to pay good attention to what they were trying to say. As a consequence, there were machines and groups and cliques that came to control the Democratic Party here and did control it for years and years and years. And nobody else was thought to speak for the Democrats except certain entrenched interests. One of the very good things, I think, that happened in recent times is the passing of the influence of older members of the party who had a throttle hold on all of its affairs. And I believe the diversity we observe now has been an improvement. And I hope indeed that the Republicans will continue to increase their strength. So we truly have a two-party system and not simply factionalism among a predominant party. Of course, I wouldn't want the Republicans to predominate either.
What do you think has been the biggest? Are there things? Is there anything that you can really pinpoint to say that you really missed, that you've seen changes in Harper? The one thing that you really feel that it's too bad it's gone, or the changes that you've seen, what's been the most dramatic thing?
No, not really. I'm dreadfully sorry that some wise group of persons did not buy the old country club in. I'm very sorry that the pressures of the moment and short-sighted politicians destroyed the old sheriff's building and jail and put up the most wretched public building that's ever been built here, which is the county office building. I'm sorry to some extent that the trees have left the principal streets in the town. But I know from being on Bel Air's committee that there are a large number of persons who are vitally and actively interested in keeping and restoring the beauty of the town. Those are all very small things, really. Aside from that, no, I have no regrets. Look at our community college. For an institution as young as it is, it's had a simply tremendous influence in this community. And it would be hard for me to choose, so far as my own activities are concerned, which I think most important, my work for the community college, for the Unitarian Fellowship, or for World Peace Programs. That's not exactly the question you asked me, and I realize it. But the things, I am not one who resists change. Indeed, that's one of the faults people find in me, that I'm so willing to see things change that I'm not sufficient traditionalist. But it's shocking to see our county go from perhaps 35,000 to 140-some thousand, and to know that it's going to 200 and then ultimately 300,000. If one recognizes that is likely to happen, one should become reconciled to the idea, and I am reconciled. All I would like to see is that it's well done, skillfully done. Cities can be beautiful as well as country themed. And there are many, many dwellings around this town and around this county that are just little retreats within themselves and spots of beauty. There are whole communities, whole areas that are charming to go through, restful to the eye. If we can keep down the noise, that'll be so much the better. No, I don't see any regret that things have changed, because I accept change as the natural order of things. I wish I'd studied a little more than I had. I wish I'd started music classes and kept them up. I wish more people would forsake their automobiles and ride bicycles as I did. And someday they will. More and more are doing so all the time. That's been another one of my follies. I didn't wait for the current bicycle craze to come along. I've been riding a bicycle since I first came to work in this community. When, and it was rather amusing, there was a woman who worked for Mrs. Close at one time, who asked her whether her husband was the good-looking one or the one that rode the bicycle. I thought that was a fair inquiry. Mm-hmm.